Hello. Today we're going to do a podcast on a sum up from the CSM session on management of atypical vestibular disorders beyond BPPV, vestibular neuritis, and acoustic neuroma. My name is Rachel Tromlin. I'm assistant professor of physical therapy at LSU Health Sciences Center in New Orleans, and I'm on with Laura Morris and Janine Holmberg, who will be speaking later. The reason we chose this topic for CSM was that we are all very familiar with vestibular therapists working with more straightforward patients, and there's really good research out there on what to do. But what do we do when we get sort of those oddball cases or those more atypical cases, and how do we problem solve, and how do we figure out what to do with the patients? One of the first things that I usually do is I will try to ask colleagues for help, but I know a lot of times in vestibular rehab, you may only have one colleague or no colleague at all doing that. The other thing that I would usually do is go looking at the literature. But again, in a complex case, there may be no literature existing supporting what we do. So the dual purpose today is to highlight some cases on a problem-solving algorithm and to also provide you guys with a little bit of a framework on what to do and how to solve through these difficult cases. First case I'm going to talk about is a patient I had a few years ago who was referred from a neuro-otologist with a diagnosis of migraine-associated dizziness versus Meniere's. She's a 49-year-old female presenting with gradual onset of dizziness, nausea, and imbalance, which has progressively worsened over the past 6 months. She does have a past medical history of migraines and premenstrual dysmorphic disorder. Her symptoms she reports as occurring in hours, occurring 1 to 2 times per week, but she's nauseous daily. And she describes the symptoms as wooziness, unsettled, and unsteady, and describes blurry vision, plus imbalance and near falls, but without falls, and having pressure and ringing in the ears bilaterally intermittently. When I performed her ocular motor tests, all bedside tests were negative, except she had a positive right head thrust test and VOR dysfunction. Excuse me, that's positive left head thrust. And Hall-Pike-Dix roll tests were negative. Her VNG findings revealed abnormal ECOGs in the left ear, which is suggestive of high drops, and abnormal VEMPs in the left ear with oscillopsia. Her balance and gait measures, her ABC was 73%. Static balance for modified sit-sib, single leg stance, Romberg and sharp Romberg eyes open were 30 seconds, and she was able to hold Romberg eyes closed 30 seconds and sharp Romberg eyes closed 15 seconds, FGA 27 out of 30, gait speed 3.85 feet per second. So you can see fairly typical unilateral vestibular hypofunction. She's a mother to a 17-year-old son, owned a boutique shop, and lives in a one-story home. Her activity limitations were she could not walk in a dark room. She was more careful on ladders. She reported lingering in bed longer and having more symptoms at work. And she was self-limiting her driving. She could, but she chose not to because she just felt uncomfortable driving longer distances. And her goals were to feel better. So this presentation, I thought, was very consistent with both parts of migraine and Meniere's, and I thought that she would benefit from vestibular rehab. I performed VOR and balance exercises with her. She came in once a week, and she performed the exercises at home, and she had minimal improvement over those 2 sessions. But in that time, she had further workup, a CAT scan, which revealed a superior semicircular canal dehiscence, to which the physician recommended that she be discharged from physical therapy and that she receive surgical treatment. So what is a superior semicircular canal dehiscence? This is a small hole that develops in the superior temporal bone superior to the semicircular canal. And the semicircular canal will move into this hole, and the jagged edges of the hole in the temporal bone cause the canal to rip. And this is due to either genetic causes or maybe trauma. And the result of this is it creates a third mobile window, which makes the ear have increased sensitivity to sound and pressure changes. And it is a relatively new diagnosis, being first described in 1998. So some of the signs that you may see are vertical and torsional eye movement with sound or pressure-induced symptoms. Obviously, you would need infrared goggles to look at this. You will see, of course, CT scan abnormalities. You may see lower level of VEMPs, and you may see a positive Weber test in the affected ear, and the patient may complain of autophony, which is that their voice sounds louder to themselves. And some of the symptoms may be patients report oscillopsia and dizziness induced by loud sounds, and patients will report a history of symptoms with a vigorous Valsalva. And the VEMPs that are used to test with this are cervical VEMPs, or I'm sorry, ocular vents, which test the utricle and superior, I'm sorry, cervical vents, which test the inferior vestibular nerve and the saccule. And the results with the fistula will demonstrate an increased amplitude, indicating involvement in the left, in the, I'm sorry, will demonstrate a decreased amplitude, or increased amplitude at a lower level. The clinical classification, our patients can have both cochlear and vestibular signs, which it occurs in most patients, and that is attributed to a larger semicircular canal dehiscence, and that's patients who complain of auditory and dizziness symptoms. Patients can also complain of auditory symptoms only or dizziness symptoms only, but that's a smaller. And research has demonstrated that the size of semicircular canal dehiscence corresponds with the symptom description and symptom severity, and also the degree of dizziness. The larger the size of the dehiscence, the more likely a patient is to have unilateral hypofunction. There is a good article done by Jenke in 2012 which examined the balance of vestibular loss and the recovery patients have status post canal plugging to treat semicircular canal dehiscence. The surgical treatment most often used is a canal plugging. They looked at patients' balance both pre-op, 1 week post-op, and 6 weeks post-op, or a greater interval, and they found that dynamic balance was impaired post-operatively, but did recover by 6 weeks, and they found that the presence of a positive head thrust was present post-operatively and at 6 weeks, and they did find that the patient had spontaneous and or post-shaking head nystagmus 1 week after surgery, and that can be indicative of the peripheral system dysfunction. So the big take-home message with this study is that patients have deficits in balance and vestibular function, which make them ideal candidates for vestibular rehab. And so this patient came back to me after 4 months about after surgery, and her symptoms have changed at that time. At that time, her symptoms were only occurring in seconds and being provoked whenever she did provoking motions, such as turning the head or doing quick body turns, which would be very typical of a unilateral vestibular lesion. She continued to complain of blurry vision when walking or with head turns and having imbalance without falls or near falls. At this time, she was not working. She closed her store, partially due to the surgery, but partially due to other personal things. She was not driving, and she was not doing as many things around her house, less cooking, increased fatigue. And she was in the process of moving, which was very stressful for her at this time. She had also gained 30 pounds since discharge from physical therapy and was very interested to start a fitness routine with a trainer for weight loss, but wanting to have her symptoms better. So her re-eval findings were very similar to her other eval findings, and I'll just highlight the important ones, where her FGA was much less at a 23 out of 30 and gait speed at less at 3.23 feet per second. And similar interventions I would do would be what you would do for unilateral vestibular hypofunction, VOR in sitting, standing, Romberg, walking forwards and walking backwards, balance training with head turns on a variety of surfaces, with eyes open, with eyes closed. She also did optokinetic stimulation, and I did habituation turns both with and without a ball toss. She attended physical therapy for 10 visits over 10 weeks. Her discharge findings, her FGA improved to a 29 out of 30, ABC at an 86.9%, and gait speed at 3.89 feet per second. And most importantly, she was able to drive 15 minutes without symptoms, able to work out with her trainer at the gym without symptoms, and she resumed all ADLs and household chores without dizziness. I was also lucky to have another case of a patient who is a 41-year-old female who complained of these symptoms. And she was very aggressive about starting therapy early because she was about to go on a vacation. So I saw her before she had the full workup. And she complained about having constant symptoms, being described as a bobblehead feeling, feeling inertia, having imbalance without falls, and having kind of a pulsatile sensation in her inner ear. All of her bedside oculomotor tests were negative except for a positive right head thrust test and VOR dysfunction. VOR times one elicited mild symptoms, and Hall-Pike sticks and roll tests were negative. Objectively, her balance looked pretty good. She was a former gymnast, and she was 41 years old, so ABC at 80%, FGA 26 out of 30, gait speed at 3.57 feet per second, SVQ was a little high at 2.35, her DHI was 40 out of 100. She's a wife and a mother to a 3-year-old son, and she planned to start work in about 3 to 4 weeks. She had been taken off to care for her son since he was born, and she has stopped walking, stopped doing yoga, and limited her driving, and her goal was to not be dizzy. And I knew the diagnosis I got from the physician was vestibular neuritis or Meniere's, and she didn't quite fit into either of those two categories. But what I did know I was working with was a unilateral lesion. It appeared to be stable, so I thought, let's kind of start a program and monitor and refer back to the physician as necessary. As luck would have it, after about 2 weeks, she had a CT scan which revealed a semicircular canal dehiscence. It was very small, so the physician opted for conservative management with vestibular rehab rather than having the patient go under for surgery. So totally, I continued with the full VOR and balance exercise program progression, followed by 4 weeks of optokinetic stimulation, and she attended 8 sessions over 9 weeks. Her outcomes with therapy, I was very pleased with. Her DHI decreased to a 6 out of 100. ABC improved to 92.5%, FGA to a 30 out of 30, and SVQ to a 0.86. And most importantly, were improvements in her activity and participation level activities. She was able to care for her son without difficulties or without the symptoms. She was able to work and do all her home duties without difficulties or symptoms. She returned to yoga and walking for exercise, and she reported no dizziness. In the last session, she reported that there was no dizziness in the past week. So looking at some of these from a differential diagnosis perspective, I think hindsight's really 20/20. That I probably should have paid more and inquired and asking a little bit more into the auditory symptoms, which may have helped me differentiate between a semicircular canal dehiscence and something like migraine-associated dizziness or vestibular neuritis. So that's the end of my part. I'm going to pass it on to Laura Morris. Laura?
Okay, I'm here. I have a case that is also very unusual. My case was a 54-year-old high school math teacher, super active, in great health, had a very supportive family, started to have a little bit of cardiac symptoms, and was found to have a significant aortic aneurysm. And he underwent repair of the aneurysm and came to see me 4 weeks after. So when he came into my office, his diagnosis was dizziness and imbalance. And in a as I started to interview him, the symptoms that he described was difficulty reading, difficulty being able to scan a room. He was a teacher, so being able to, look around the room and see his students was really hard, and he felt off balance. I did an oculomotor screen of him and found something very unusual and not what I expected at all. What I found was that his vestibular ocular reflex was intact. His dynamic visual acuity score was normal. He had no head impulse test that was positive. All of that was fine. His smooth pursuit was intact. His VOR suppression was intact, and Virgin's was intact. What was not intact was his saccadic eye movements, and those were painfully slow. He had a very difficult time being able to turn his head and turn his eyes in order to get onto a target, and any kind of saccades that you would need for reading were present, but just very, very slow. This made obviously function difficult. So my initial reaction was to run into the other room, well, not run, walk quickly into the other room and look up anything I could find on this subject. And there actually was some information that I could put my hands on quickly, and just, sort of make sure that this was something that somebody else had seen at some point. And it turns out that there are two papers on the subject that I found after the first session. One of them is by Solomon in the Annals of Neurology in 2008, called Psychotic Palsy After Cardiac Surgery, Characteristics and Pathogenesis. And the other article is by Eggers, and it's actually, it's in Neurology in 2008. And it's called Selective Psychotic Palsy After Cardiac Surgery. So they're very similar papers that describe this exact problem. Once I took a look at the patient that first day, I then realized that none of my typical outcome measures were going to be appropriate beyond basic gait and balance things. So I needed to come up with some objective way of monitoring this patient's recovery. So I attempted the King-Devick test, or King-Devick test, depending on tomato or tomato, and he was unable to perform that test at that time, initially. So instead, I used a timed reading sample, and I was able to do that initially and then monthly to record his progress. And then I also just made up a psychotic eye movement test in which I had the patient stand arm's length away from the wall and put two targets 3 feet apart. And what I asked him to do is have his head and his eyes pointed at one target, and then let me know when his eyes had reached when he could see the second target. Obviously, this is a clinical test that I did, but it gave me some interesting information. Initially, it took him a full 30 seconds to go from the left target to the right target. I'm sorry, a full 7 seconds to go from the left target to the right target, and a full 4 seconds to go from the left target to the right target to the left target. So 7 left to right and 4 right to left. So that was what I used for my initial outcome measures to look at his psychotic eye movements. Functionally, he scored an 18 out of 30 on the functional gait assessment. He had difficulty with head turns and gait. As you can imagine, his eyes lagged behind his head, so that made head turns difficult. He had trouble turning around and with obstacle negotiation because it took him a long time to get his eyes focused on whatever it was he was, stepping over the steps and things was difficult. His static balance was fine. With dynamic balance, again, he had any head turns caused postural instability. Functionally, he was unable to read. He was unable to drive. He had a lot of difficulty with ADLs just by virtue of not being able to get his eyes on the whatever it was he was trying to do. Moving about the kitchen was difficult, buttoning his shirt, things like that. He had a very difficult time when he entered a room because it took him so long to get his head and his eyes to match up to see what was happening in the room. If you can imagine, I mean, we use psychotic eye movements to do everything. And so those things were difficult for him. Obviously, in community environments, he couldn't visually scan, so making his way around was difficult. So what did I do for intervention? The two articles that I mentioned say nothing about his actual psychotic eye movements improving. It says nothing about any of the patients who have been written up having rehab. So what I was doing was just using the knowledge that I have on eye-head coordination to come up with a plan for his care. So the first thing I did was have him utilize his intact systems. So he used target following during gait. So I would have him actually like put his thumb up below his, below horizontal a little bit, and then have him turn his eyes and his thumb together to visually scan. basically using Smooth Pursuit to assist in visually scanning. And he also developed a compensatory technique in which he would turn his head very quickly past where he wanted to see, and then his eyes would lag behind. They would land on what he wanted to see, and then he would turn his eyes back to the target. So it was a compensatory technique that he was able to use to get his eyes on a target. We did work on saccadic tasks because I didn't know for sure if his saccades would improve or not. We started with large words for reading, and he practiced every day for as long as he could stand it. And we did some visual scanning in simple environments where he wasn't having to turn his eyes or his head very far. We also worked on using his peripheral vision to help manage complex environments because they, you know, that would help him gain more information about his environment without having to turn his head too much. Over time, we progressed to smaller fonts during reading and doing actual head turns in gait and trying to get his eyes to stay along with his head. We did a lot of dynamic standing tasks that included reaching and eye head movements. And we did some driving simulation. This was mostly because he was very motivated to drive again. I was not sure that he would ever be ready or safe to drive, but I wanted him to work toward what his goals were. And so we did lots of things that simulated driving. And we also worked on in complex environments with busy backgrounds so that he could learn to manage in those environments. So I saw him for 14 weeks. Initially, I saw him for 2 times a week, and then I cut down to 1 time a week once he got the hang of what we were doing. Over time, he returned to work as a teacher. He actually had an assistant teacher that helped him in his classes initially, and he reported that worked out great. He still had difficulty visually scanning the room, and so sometimes it was difficult for him to see if a student had a question. He reported right until the end that walking around the campus and in the hallways at school were really difficult because students would say, you know, "Hi, Mr. Bill," "Hi, Mr. Bill," and he wouldn't be able to tell who said hi to him until they were long gone, because by the time he got his eyes and his head to the student, they had, you know, likely walked past him. He ended up being able to read at what he described as a functional speed. It was nothing like what he read before, but at least he got to the point where he could read. He did use some techniques like a envelope at the bottom of the line just to help make his saccadic eye movements a little less complex. But other than that, he was able to go back to doing some reading. That saccadic task that I talked about in the beginning, I repeated, and by the end, he was able to do 1.5 seconds going from left to right, and 1 second going from right to left, which was a huge improvement from where he started. And again, whether that was because I actually made a change in his ability to make a saccadic eye movement, I don't know. What I was concerned about was, could I get him to use what he had functionally and efficiently? So, you know, the movement that I was asking him to do involved head and eye movements, and I think he likely got just much better at being able to coordinate the two. Statically and dynamically, he reported by the end that his balance was better than before, and he certainly got to be very good at that. His functional gait assessment score improved from 18 out of 30 to 28 out of 30, with head turns still being his biggest problem. He was exercising regularly at the gym, and he did hope to drive eventually. I don't know if he was ever going to get there, but I wasn't going to be the one to tell him, "You never will." I just said, you know, you're not ready yet. So one question is, you know, why such success? How did he do, why did he do so well? And part of it, I think, was because he had incredible determination. He loved his work and was desperate to get back to it. And so he was working really, really hard at his therapy in order to get back to what he loved to do. He always had a physically active lifestyle, and he continued to be physically active even when his world was very unclear to him. He had a very good outlook. He was a very positive person, and he had a great sense of humor, and I think this helped him a lot. He was also very disciplined and was willing to keep doing the, you know, the amount of practice that it took to develop these new skills. And I would, you know, I would say that they're fairly boring to repeat over and over and over again, but he did it because he wanted to be better. He also had a very supportive wife and kids, and I think that also helps tremendously. So really, when you talk about management of these kinds of patients, one of the first things that I think is important to look at is, what is the status of his eye movements based on the five major classes of eye movements? And those five major classes are saccades, smooth pursuit, vergence, the vestibular ocular reflex, and the optokinetic system. And so, you know, I looked at those systems and said, okay, what impairments does he have, and what impairments does he not have? And then, are those impairments permanent, or is there potential for improvement? And in his case, we didn't know if there was potential in improvement in his actual saccadic eye movements, but I did think at the very least I could make a difference in how well he coordinated his eye and head movements. It's important to, when you're thinking about what to do with a patient like this, to think about giving the patient compensatory techniques that in the short term will help them function, because the quicker somebody gets back to function, the better. And then looking at neuromuscular re-education techniques and a lot of practice to help improve the specific oculomotor or vestibular functions that you are trying to improve. So I think a balanced approach of giving somebody compensatory techniques so that they can make it through their day, and then at the same time working on the true impairments and improving those is a good way to work at things. It's important to consider the evidence, but you know, in some of these cases there is no evidence. There was absolutely no evidence for this patient's rehab. All I knew for sure was that this disorder existed and a little bit about why. It's really important when we're working with patients like this that you're aware of what mechanism that you're employing. You know, I did not need to work on adaptation with this patient because his vestibular ocular reflex was intact. But knowing that, you know, I was using similar techniques that we use with other vestibular patients and employing them for a novel case is important. And I think that's it for me. Next is Janine. And so
All right. Okay. Sorry. Awesome cases. So my case is a 64-year-old man who slipped and fell hard on the ice and landed on his left side and his left knee. And initially, over about a three-day period of time, started noticing increasing dizziness to the point that he had a very severe vestibular crisis with vomiting and visiting the emergency department. At the emergency department, all serious causes were ruled out, and benign positional vertigo was suspected, and at that time, an FV was performed. 5 days later, he was referred to an audiologist for benign positional vertigo treatment. In reviewing the notes that I got, he was noted to have a mild geotrophic direction-changing nystagmus that was more intense on the left. However, the nystagmus persisted and was, overall, when you read the notes, was weak. as far as the overall intensity of it. He was treated for possible horizontal canal VTBV, but his symptoms persisted, and by day 9, they tried to switch to treating the other side, and still without much success. 2 weeks later, following the onset of his injury, because of his persistent dizziness, a full VNG was completed, and all his central findings for gaze, saccade, and smooth pursuit were normal. Positionally, he was found to have some square wave jerks with fixation removed only, and he was noted to have a mixed kind of up and apogeotrophic direction change in nystagmus that was primarily asymptomatic, and it was documented as a mild nystagmus at about 2 to 3 degrees per second. And the Dix Hallpike testing and roll testing was negative for any paroxysmal nystagmus or something consistent with benign positional vertigo. Caloric testing did reveal a 48% left unilateral weakness with a significant directional preponderance. The overall interpretation from the audiologist was that he had a documented left unilateral hyperfunction, and his positional nystagmus was non-localizing, meaning it could have suggested central or peripheral, and she noted that square wave jerks were suggestive of possible CNS dysfunction. At that point, he was referred to physical therapy for vestibular rehabilitation and to monitor and treat for possible benign positional vertigo. The doctor, given the findings that he found, started him on prednisone with a diagnosis of, at that point, of viral neuritis. And what I find when I'm looking at a patient that's coming to me from audiology is very often it is important for us as physical therapists to be able to look at the VNG testing and analyze exactly, you know, what's the quality of that report, and do we understand the significance of the report as far as it's going to be for us to understand it. So we know that the significance of positional nystagmus is that it should be above 5 degrees per second, which is considered strong, or if it is more milder, it needs to be in multiple positions in order for it to be considered significant. There is a number of nystagmus that, with the advent of infrared goggles, we as physical therapists will be identifying, and we need to understand there is a level of nystagmus that is considered significant and not significant. And so the positional nystagmus in this man on his VNG testing would be considered non-localizing, would have to be viewed with respect to the rest of the testing. With square wave jerks, criteria is often that it needs to be greater than 2 degrees per second and present at all times, with vision present, independent of the position. So by this definition, actually his square wave jerks were not significant, they were not in room light, and they were not persistent at a 2 per second frequency. So this would not have been considered significant by a number of the criteria that are established. The caloric test is definitely highly significant for a unilateral hyperfunction, and so from his initial presentation, very much looking like a vestibular neuritis patient. When I did my examination on the dizziness handicap inventory, he scored with severe, an 84 out of 100, and his current dizziness subjectively rated on a visual analog scale is 5 out of 10. Past medical history was significant for a total knee replacement on his right, sinusitis, allergies, and sleep apnea. He does have a long history of motion sickness vulnerabilities, and I find that an important quality that we should identify as physical therapists, as vestibular therapists, because very often someone with a vulnerability of motion sickness is more difficult to work with, can be much more sensitive, and I find healing times perhaps a little bit more protracted than someone without that history. And it's also an important factor that sometimes suggests a possibility of, it's been associated with patients with migraine. He denies any headaches or any hearing difficulties, which we're always looking for any kind of comorbidity or any kind of unstable lesion as we look at someone who's coming in with us with a significant unilateral loss. Are we the first person who's seen the start of an unstable lesion? Should be something that should be questioned if it's an early onset vestibular exacerbation. He does have some chronic neck stiffness that's exacerbated since his fall. Unable to tolerate any normal exercise, in which he was usually very active with racquetball and golfing and a number of recreational activities, which he was not back. And at the time I first saw him, he was not back to work at a desk job. His initial testing for clinical impairments showed elevated sway in Romberg, no spontaneous or gaze evoked, nystagmus in room light, and with fixation removed. His smooth pursuit and saccades were normal quality, and I was also looking for his tolerance, and his tolerance was normal. He had a positive head impulse test with corrective saccades to the left, consistent with that left unilateral hypofunction. And his dynamic visual acuity was with a six-line loss of visual acuity, which is again, consistent with the unilateral loss. He had a positive after head shake, six beats to the right. His cervical range of motion was within normal limits with some painful end feels noted. His sitting vertebral artery screen, you know, was not provocative of any kind of symptoms. And on the clinical tests for sensory interaction on balance, he is falling in conditions where he must rely on his vestibular system. His gait was kind of classic vestibular, reduced velocity, on-block maneuvering, and frequent wall and veer touch. His functional gait assessment was within fall risk criteria at 17 out of 30, where scores below 23 reflect heightened fall risk. His initial presentation under the infrared goggles showed no evidence of a gaze evoked nystagmus. The positional testing, there was some inconsistent square waves as the audiologist had looked at. And he primarily had an asymptomatic right beating nystagmus, especially when he was on his left side. There was no evidence of benign positional vertigo, even to additional BPV testing such as bow and lean, roll testing, so no indication of BPVV. He was testing with quite a high motion sensitivity with a motion sensitivity quotient of 30%, which was kind of more generalized without evidence of, again, of anything of benign positional vertigo. So for his initial assessment, a poorly compensated acute unilateral loss with very vestibular-specific impairments and disability, including that abnormal head impulse test, dynamic visual acuity, and the loss of balance under vestibular conditions. His presentation was certainly consistent with vestibular neuritis. However, I can't rule out that this is the early presentation of an unstable lesion, such as Meniere's or remotely migraine. I anticipated 4 follow-ups to progress in adaptation, habituation, sensory balance retraining program, and gait retraining program. His initial therapy was VOR times 1 at near and far, learning how to ground to improve his stabilization and kind of up-training his use of somatosensory information, and then gait with increasing head motions and increasing his fitness. 3 weeks following, he was much improved, drove independently to his appointment. He had talked that he had returned to work. His neck was still slightly tight, with increasing complaints of headaches, severe cranial base tightness, and light traction was relieving. So I actually started doing some light cervical intervention at the same time. Computerized dynamic visual acuity testing showing a logMAR deficit of 0.2 to the left and 0.1 to the right, where normal is less than 0.15, so still a little bit elevated on his left hypofunctioning side. Gaze stabilization had increased to 115 degrees per second to the left to the right, and then 96 degrees per second to the left, where values we know are greater than 80 for the capacity to drive. He was given some home exercise programs, gentle cervical range of motion, some posture retraining to get him out of his forward head, increased the VOR exercises with narrowing base of support, increasing eyes closed demands even with narrowing base of support, and increasing demands even when he's walking. On his second follow-up, which is now about 4 weeks post his injury, he comes back describing a horrific week, which with what he thought was stomach flu, throwing up, dizziness and vertigo, as intense as his initial presentation where he went to the emergency department, and he said that he was in bed for a 3-day period of time. His ear was full with a questionable change in hearing, but he had gone to his doctor and had confirmed a stable hearing just the day before my appointment. He had severe neck pain and head fullness. He denied any headache or migraine history, but did admit to a lifelong history of visual phenomenon that can last for hours. I often find that patients are not good at identifying whether they have migraine involvement, and very often ocular migraine is often associated with someone who could be going on to develop a vestibular migraine presentation. He does admit to definite light and sound sensitivity during his severe exacerbation, and certainly if you're trying to build a case for a possible migraine involvement, you'd want to be looking for what we would call migraine travelers, or things that go with migraine, such as light and sound sensitivity. When I did his infrared examination on this day, instead of seeing this mild direction fixed nystagmus with kind of diffuse dizziness, he had this severe apogeotrophic direction change in nystagmus on his roll testing. But then in supine, he had a marked upbeating. And if I put him in prone or in the bowel testing with his head down, it would reverse to a downbeat. So he basically had multi-directional nystagmus, both up and down. And BPV could not account for this at this point. Left posterior canal, in his left exhalpike, there was a possible torsional component to the initial presentation, which could have been interpreted or supportive of benign positional vertigo, for which we did a catalytic positioning. However, there was no effect on that. So his presentation at this point is more supportive of, and consistent with, vestibular migraine, because he's got this direction change in nystagmus that cannot be accounted for with benign positional vertigo. He's got migraine travelers of light and sound sensitivity. He's got a past history of episodic ocular, what could be consistent with ocular migraines. And again, this positional nystagmus that cannot be accounted for with benign positional vertigo. He was referred for a neurologist at this time, and I began some migraine education as far as particularly the power of a migraine to create dizziness, which is usually something that needs to be explained to a patient. And I started talking about what are the conservative treatment strategies that can be utilized to control migraine, including the role of diet, exercise, pacing, and hydration. And his treatment went on hold pending medical stabilization of his acute migraine. And what I just think we need to recognize as physical therapists is the power of a migraine is quite amazing as far as what kind of findings you can see. The literature does support that you can see central findings of impaired smooth pursuit. You can see peripheral vestibular asymmetries, usually in the more mild category at 20% to 40% caloric weaknesses. The nystagmus that has been associated with migraine is all across the board, as noted in a study done by Polensk and Tusa in 2010, where they noted that their migraine patients could present with spontaneous nystagmus, horizontal after head shake nystagmus, and positional nystagmus was noted in 100% of the cases. A large majority of the time, at least 76% of the time, that was sustained and without any degree of paroxysmal qualities. There was direction changing and direction fixed, such as, and the direction changes, such as in this case, there's up and down beating and torsional that has been documented. So we know that a number of central findings and peripheral findings can be seen in cases of documented migraine. He was placed on a migraine prophylactic and sent to some cervical-specific physical therapists, physical therapy due to the possible trigger and involvement with his neck. He returned to my clinic 4 months later reporting that he wasn't floating anymore but was still having some distinct positional dizziness, especially when he looked up, some blurry vision and some motion-provoked instability. His reassessment at that time showed some normal velocity and quality of his gait. His Romberg was normal, but he still was falling in the clinical test for sensory interaction and balance in 5 and 6, the vestibular conditions. He no longer had a positive head impulse test, and his dynamic visual acuity was to a 3-line loss versus a 6-line loss, which it was initially. His cervical range of motion had improved following the therapy that he'd received. There was no spontaneous or gaze evoked. There was still a mild positive after head shake nystagmus of 4 beats. And now and when I did his clinical examination with the infrared goggles at this point, he had a total resolve in that direction changing, alarming direction changing nystagmus that he'd had on the previous examination, and now showed a very classic left torsional upbeat nystagmus of 20-second duration in the left exhalpike. So he was significantly improved, but with definable benign positional vertigo, and then also with some incomplete compensation and healing for his left equilateral deficit, his migraine was stabilizing and his cervical complaints were normalizing. And so I recommended following up to stabilize his benign positional vertigo and further advance some habituation, adaptation, and balancer training for the residual complaints that were going on. At his follow-up, he was reporting that he was significantly better since the repositioning maneuver, but not back to his full wellness program. He still had a subtle left leaning after head shake nystagmus. His benign positional vertigo was in remission per the Dix-Halbach testing and per subjective report. He was advancing his VOR times one. He was taught, you know, self-catalyst repositioning principles should he experience any residual complaints. And in his final testing, he actually did finally pass with his eyes very stable, which is, it's kind of amazing. And I always think unless you actually see the videos, you wouldn't believe how much this man's eyes changed and how much this migraine can cause quite an alarming, huge degree of what looks like scary eye movement, you know, because we've got a lot of direction-changing qualities, but also that he had to be tracked carefully because we know that benign positive vertigo has a higher incidence with patients who are experiencing migraine. So his final outcome was that his dizziness handicap inventory had cleared from an 84 to a 24, his severity rating from a 5 to a 3, and he was back to his wellness program by the time we finished up his testing. His functional gait assessment was a 29 versus a 17. He could stand and heel toe, both with eyes open and eyes closed. His single leg stance was back up to where it should be, and he was able to stand under conditions where he must rely on his vestibular system with good motion tolerance. And so the bottom line is kind of the take-home message, I think, that perhaps all these three cases, all these three presentations say is that you've got complicated cases that often might require some reassessment, some revisiting in the clinical findings, a careful understanding of the disabilities and the impairments that you're looking at, and that very often not only are you going to have to customize your treatment approaches, you may have to customize exactly how you're going to document the progress, such as Laura was showing. We're going to need to be searching the literature to understand, you know, what is going on with the different presentations that we're looking at. But there is going to be a hole that we're going to have to fill with our skills as a clinician and also with networking with other therapists. You know, and identifying the qualities of success like Laura did as far as the resiliency of the patient, tapping into this patient's assets and looking for really customizing to this patient's distinct impairments. We certainly know that in today's world where benign positional vertigo is more well respected, that there's a number of patients who therapists are calling the problem benign positional vertigo, where there is a lot of nystagmus that, and positional nystagmus that goes beyond benign positional vertigo. And had, in my case, I had treated just the benign positional vertigo, I would have been grossly insufficient in taking care of his case and in managing him. And had I just even identified just the unilateral deficiency and treated that, I would have also been insufficient had I not looked for evidence for the instability of his lesion and for a comorbidity that would require an interaction with the medical community and for medical stabilization. So these atypical cases can be both a diagnostic and treatment dilemma. We've got to listen very, very carefully to the history and the subjective complaints, which are going to be critical not only for our diagnosis but for exactly how we're going to treat these specific impairments. You need to be willing to do these reassessments, and the clinical testing is going to be a very vital part, and I would actually advocate for the fact that our clinical testing that a physical therapist can offer can give some of the most key differential diagnosis pieces that can help a doctor properly care for a patient. So our role in these cases are very strong. Our role in decreasing disability and identifying these cases and getting the proper medical care is going to be very high. And with atypical cases, we're going to have to express a high degree of skill, creative customization of exercise programs and progressions, and even where the evidence is lacking. And so with difficult cases, be willing to ask colleagues, be willing to go to the vestibular SIG resources, such as the neuropt.org, identify mentors in your field, and really be willing to pull out the creative stops to customize for these patients, because there is a vital role that we play in minimizing disability and optimizing their recovery for these complicated issues that medicine really has a lot of holes with. And so with that, I will give it back to Rachel for the sign-off.
Thank you so much, Laura and Janine, for your input. It was a great presentation, and the reason we wanted to do a podcast was to have it available for those who were unable to attend. Please see the Vestibular SIG website for other podcasts and other great information. Again, thanks again, and take care.